Guido, they just say, you know, quien de algo menos caro, a qué hora se sirven las comidas, hay agua.
Dígame, ¿cómo se llega al centro? Residencial. To the city. A la ciudad. To the village. Al pueblo. Where do I turn? Donde.
For the lesbian. On the West Coast, DOB endorsements of any group generally were accomplished only after inclusion of important DOB officers on the executive and policy shaping committees of that group. The shortage of official policy and principles placed a premium on visibility and personal attractiveness. The other side of the coin, it diminished the contribution and democratic participation of less presentable gay women. We're very fortunate in the personal attractiveness of our visible lesbians. Without exception, they were wholesome, charming types. Ladies, you would indeed enjoy taking out to lunch. Many years later, some of the members of the executive board of the Daughters were discussing achievements of the group among ourselves. And Phyllis Lyon, who for many years had acted as public relations director, exclaimed, "Well, we have at least completely destroyed the old false image of the lesbian. And what have we replaced that image with?" we asked. "Me," Phyllis replied cheerfully. Contrasted with the personality approach of the West Coast, East Coast leaders were considerably more concerned with principle. Both Miss Giddings and Miss Glass concerned themselves with two major objectives. One, to make the word homosexual accepted as fit to print, and two, the right of lawful, peaceful association. As you may recall, the 1957 Articles of Incorporation made no reference to the sexual orientation of members or indicated any organizational concern for the lesbian. Shortly after the chapter was formed in New York, Mattachine Society was incorporated in New York State as a homophile organization. Among the signers, as organizers of that group, was Marion Glass. Mattachine Society became the first homophile organization in New York State. From that time on through 1968, Marion Glass and her colleagues devoted a major portion of their energy to try and establish the Daughters of Bilitis in New York State, both as an official organization of that state and as the first woman's organization to be accepted by any state as a homophile organization. The importance and significance of the New York State incorporation was not comprehended by a majority of DOB members, including our Western chapters. Gay pride was then a thing of the future, and many considered labeling the organization anything other than a general social club would cause unnecessary trouble. Others felt the unity of the organization would be severed by the existence of more than one incorporated group, Daughters of Bilitis. In the end, Marion Glass was unsuccessful. The first submission of the New York State Articles of Incorporation was rejected by state officials on the grounds that the corporation might prove to be undesirable. We then advised our lawyers to pursue the matter further, determining if possible the reasons for this opinion, and to take whatever steps seem desirable to achieve incorporation in the state of New York as a homophile organization. So convinced were Miss Willer and Miss Glass of the need and timeliness of incorporation in the various sovereign states as a homophile organization, they took nearly a year visiting the various chapters, particularly the West Coast chapters, talking to members, talking at chapter meetings, trying to explain to the membership the historic necessity of this step. Let us again return to New York in 1958. One difficulty in arousing New York women to champion their personal liberties was that for all practical purposes at that time, the New York State law against sodomy could not be applied to women. This law has since been revised. Our members generally believed that they experienced social and economic disadvantages principally because they were women. They never had the opportunity of experience discrimination because of their sexual orientation. Some members felt that our activities on behalf of lesbians gave more employers a rationale to discriminate against single women, gay or otherwise. The greatest attraction of the daughters in New York for the average gay girl was the opportunity it provided her to expand her social contacts. Social events were ever popular, such as parties, gab, and jabbas. These were rapt sessions over coffee. But there was a rapid turnover, as some lesbians learned that, after all, the simple coincidence of having the same sexual orientation frequently did not provide enough mutual interest for continued association. The daughters was oriented towards working with the individual, and in this area it was quite successful. Scores of women found necessary moral support through group acceptance and referral services. The middle-class lesbian did become more visible. Some useful dialogue was established with the churches. Some inroads were made in the public media. It may come now as a shock to our young people that for many years even the Well of Loneliness was considered pornographic. For years it was published in English in Paris and smuggled past custom officers by tourists. Historically, the first breakthrough came when the United States Post Office lost its Supreme Court case against One magazine and others. The Post Office had attempted to prohibit use of the mails to circulate materials that referred to homosexuality or was apt to appeal to homosexual interests. The Supreme Court concluded that homosexuality was a condition and not pornographic per se. This ruling permitted publications such as One, The Ladder, and chapter newsletters to use the mails. A second breakthrough came when the New York Times permitted Reverend Wood to advertise his book, Christ and the Homosexual, in their Sunday magazine sections. The New York Times official policy still held that the word homosexual could not be included in all the news that's fit to print, but this was an important exception. However, the third major significant breakthrough really let down the floodgates. Along about 1965, and Barbara can probably supply the correct date, a joint conference of homophile groups, including the Daughters of Bilitis and Mattachine, was held in Philadelphia. That conference attempted to place an advertisement of its meeting in the New York Times. The New York Times editors tell us that an editorial conference at the highest level was called by the Times. The New York Times position on the treatment of homosexual press releases was entirely revised. We're told the basic cost of that policy conference to the New York Times far exceeded the price we paid for this historic ad. We doubt that the ad brought many visitors to the conference, but it did make homosexuality an accepted topic in the New York Times, and other newspapers followed suit. It was an essential major step shaping the course of subsequent development of the homophile movement. Another illustration of the temperament of those times. The Civil Liberties Union was approached to determine whether they would be willing to endorse New York State adoption of law reform to remove sanctions against consensual adult sexual activities from the New York State Penal Code. Unofficially, but some members asserted that there was considerable difference between civil liberties and personal liberties. Pursuit of happiness is not protected by the United States Constitution. The ACLU at that time could be called upon to assist citizens in obtaining equal justice under existing law. But the ACLU was not then concerned with changing law. A possible reason for the ACLU low profile was the extensive trial at Foley Square in which they were involved to determine if the Communist Party, per se, was a subversive organization. This had left the ACLU in New York with the unattractive image of being supportive of fellow travelers. Its financial support was greatly reduced. Like any volunteer group, the New York ACLU wanted attractive issues which would bring support, not create additional enemies. A further illustration of existing attitudes in New York. Many bars were from time to time closed on the general grounds that they were congregating places for perverts. Although New York Daughters of Bilitis were never subject to such charges, this may have been possibly because most of its meetings were too small to attract public attention. It was nevertheless an interest to the daughters to raise the issue of the legality of perverts congregating. Aren't the rights of perverts protected by the constitutional freedom to assembly? However, there was great difficulty in locating any bar willing to challenge that ruling. It is a well-known fact, but difficult to establish, that there's considerable mafia influence in the operation of gay bars in New York, at least at that time. With priority over these issues, there was the basic problem of keeping the group together. The young New York group had considerable difficulties reaching its potential membership of making the public aware that it even existed. To the end of obtaining publicity, we frequently extended information and material cooperation to some rather hostile writers and commentators. The rationale was that although the writer would write whatever he pleased anyway, we should provide our side of the matter, and we might get a fairer treatment. Even by mentioning that there was an organization for those filthy perverts, some readers who needed us may have started to look for us. We received a couple of headlines in one of the leading yellow sheets with this sort of wording, quote, Miss X, capitalized, welcomes lesbians. 4 weeks, odd characters came around looking for Miss X. So each week we selected a different Miss X to act as a chapter hostess for whoever might choose to come around to inspect us. The public relations task of getting the written word to the public and or our potential friends and members frequently had far more pleasant aspects. Donald Webster Corey has been considered the father of the homophile movement. His contributions to Mattachine and other organizations were significant and numerous, but his fame rests on his book, The Homosexual in America. Hundreds of readers wrote to him stating that they too believed they were homosexuals or knew somebody who was, and would like to be referred to organizations, groups, or persons with sympathetic views, which he did. Many years later, Dr. Corey wrote Lesbian in America. By this time, Dr. Corey's influence in the movement had waned. Unfortunately, Mr. Corey believed that homosexuals had, for practical purposes, to accept the definition of homosexuality as a medical condition. This establishment terminology carried unattractive implications of illness and disease and was repugnant to the movement. Nevertheless, we are very grateful to Dr. Corey for his efforts, and some chapters on the New York Daughters of Bilitis were written in the DOB office. The Lesbian in America was not sensational in sales volume. The public took much more happily to Jess Stern's Grapevine. While I may prefer Dr. Corey's dignified treatment, there is no doubt that the Lesbian received far greater publicity from the Grapevine and its several paperback reprints than she ever had through Lesbian in America. Mr. Stern also provided several opportunities for members of the Daughters to join him on radio programs across the country discussing his books and the problems of the lesbian. I hope you will forgive me, but this was my concern for 10 years, and the various meetings, conferences, demonstrations, and activities tend to blur together. It is difficult to remember just when the demonstration on the steps of the San Francisco City Hall occurred. I recall several demonstrations about Independence Hall, Philadelphia. I think one was a Law Day demonstration, another an Independence Day demonstration. But there were many other meetings and demonstrations. Reminiscing on the Lesbian in America reminds me of a conference that the Daughters of Bilitis and other homophile organizations participated in the city of Washington, D.C. Now, there existed across the river a group of the American Nazi Party, and they too were looking for publicity, and they had some apparently worthwhile contacts in the media, because when they appeared, they had with them television cameras as well as reporters. At that conference, there was a group of representatives of various faiths discussing the churches toward the homosexual. This distinguished panel included a priest, a rabbi, and several ministers. In the panel audience, there was also a large delegation of the ministers of the Methodist Churches of America, who were holding their own conference at the same hotel. Also in attendance, but not quite so publicly, was a charming, delightful, wholesome, red-headed Irishman from the FBI. We were confidentially informed of his presence by friends, so that when we needed him, we knew who and where to look for him. At the conclusion of the religious panel, as the group was about to disperse, there was a considerable commotion heard in the hall, and with it the arrival of television cameras, reporters, and a delegation from the National Nazi Group across the river. They wished to deliver a package to the rabbi. They approached the panelist, and their messenger opened his large package, which contained a 5-gallon jar of Vaseline, and they proceeded to make a presentation with exceedingly rude remarks to the rabbi. The Catholic priest, an elderly gentleman, short, stocky, white-haired, did his best to interpose himself between the rabbi and the rude rabble-rouser. But Shirley Willer and Barbara Giddings had a better idea. It also prevented further involvement of our audience and guests, who were extremely indignant at the treatment being accorded the rabbi. Barbara Giddings, Shirley Willer, Kay Tobin, and several of the women present joined hands and circled the Nazi demonstrators, bringing their circle closer and closer around the demonstrating group, as I departed to bring our delegate from the FBI onto the scene. That gentleman arrived post-haste, pulled out his badge, and put the group of Nazis under his custody, removing them from the conference floor. In the process of doing so, his activities as an agent of the FBI was picked up by the television cameras. Later, the FBI agent asked us to refuse permission to show the televised scene in which he was clearly identified as an FBI agent in order to protect his usefulness to the FBI. We, of course, agreed, despite the loss of such potentially good publicity. We also regretted the inconvenience he suffered, and as a small token of our appreciation for his timely services, we took a copy of Lesbian in America, and each of us, Barbara, Kay, Shirley, and I, signed our names in it. So somewhere in this country, there is an FBI agent with his personal copy of Lesbian in America, signed by some notable lesbians of America. For 10 years, I did the best I could in working through the Daughters of Bilitis and Mattachine for the lesbian. We Catholics have at least one saving grace, the philosophy that it is immodest to be a martyr. I've held each elected New York chapter position, other than secretary, at some time or other, and my major reason for not being DOB chapter secretary was that for many years I served as secretary of New York Mattachine, and I felt that confusion would be inevitable. I have served on the national board of the Daughters of Bilitis, both as public relations director and as recording secretary. I've done my best, and I felt the time was overdue for others to try their hand. I felt the organization could not prosper without greater flexibility and renewed vision. Without vision, the people perish. We did not achieve our goal of establishing the first legally recognized association of acknowledged gay women and their friends. But if nothing else, the New York Daughters of Bilitis was available for 10 continuous years to assist the gay woman of New York. Returning now to the problems of the Daughters. Disagreements within the governing board of the Daughters of Bilitis often arose not from the confrontation of good and evil, but more often from the choice between idealism and practicality. A kudo to Barbara Giddings for insisting that lesbian was the word fit to print on our latter covers. This, as Del Martin wrote 5 years later, and as had been predicted, proved only that the lesbian will not purchase a magazine marked lesbian from the newsstands. In our time, the governing board was composed of officers elected at the biennial General Assembly by the membership present in person or by written proxy. In the 2 years between General Assemblies, members were theoretically not responsible to anyone. It was at times difficult to locate particular governing board members or to require their attention to obligations assumed by them in the feverish environment of the General Assembly. It was also difficult and expensive for conscientious board members to acquire information about issues in different distant locations necessary to arrive at dispassionate and judicious decisions. On occasion, I did visit with distant chapters to review my positions with them. But since board member travel had to be financed from the member's own pocket, effective board participation was an indulgence reserved mainly for the more affluent members. Thus, once again, economics limited the contribution of the poorer lesbian. Most frequently, I accepted as basic the good faith of my fellow board members. I respected their recommendations as based on their considered wisdom and special knowledge of local conditions. I knew these women personally as dedicated and sincere. When asked as a board member to approve DOB participation in other remote groups unknown in the New York area, such a citizen's alert, I invariably approved. Under the restrictions of time and money, there was no better source of wisdom than the area's own board member. But other board members could not, in good conscience, accept on mere faith the proposals of their fellow members. Some board members wanted all major decisions postponed to the biennial assemblies. Since the agendas of assemblies were always overcrowded, and the general membership seldom had the time or background to consider major issues in depth, postponement had the effect of defeating any question, especially where timeliness was important. The cross-country composition of the board required that either you accept on faith or reject. Faith seemed to me the lesser evil. But some board members effectively immobilized the organization with their preoccupation with the good image of the daughters. The National Governing Board, the highest authority of the daughters between assemblies, was an unworkable mechanism both for administration and for rational policy making. While the innovations in communications and the inroads in the news media were essential and probably the most important advance in our time, there are other areas of social ferment that contributed to the changing social attitudes. Research served to churn up new or unanswered questions. The Kinsey researchers contacted the lesbian community in San Francisco, and several members of the daughters assisted in contacting subjects for the study. Unfortunately, the findings of the Kinsey group were limited by the size of sample they were able to obtain at that time. The larger sample study, which formed the basis of the report on male homosexuality, became the focus of public discussion. DOB Research Director Florence Conrad perceived the usefulness of the contacts of the Daughters of Bilitis as a sample of gay women, a sample useful to researchers. And to prove it, she used the latter contacts as the sample basis for her own study published in the latter. This also gave some objective basis, however tentative, to DOB pronouncements on the composition and characteristics of the lesbian community. I am sure Ms. Conrad's work made impressions on the thinking of Dr. Evelyn Hooker and Dr. Joel Fort and other open-minded researchers of those times. For example, this and a television program in Cleveland eventually led Dr. Mark Friedman to undertake his studies on homosexuality, which led to the publication of several important papers. But at all times, the daughters provided a public forum for such investigators as Dr. Bieber, Dr. Ellis, and Dr. Wardell Pomeroy, whose reports, we hope, serve to demonstrate to the public the diversity of scientific opinion on the lesbian. It assisted us in posing the question, is this the rationale on which you base your laws and attitudes? With this background, it was then difficult for the daughters to change from their position that we have an alternate for your consideration to we know the answer. How could we express the omnipotent opinion that our organization now knows better than any of these professional students? It is easy for us to say homosexuality is not an evil, but it's up to society to recognize it. The onus of society is dressed in various terms at various times. In clerical society, homosexuality is defined as a sin. In a police society, homosexuality is a crime. In a pseudoscientific society, homosexuality is a sickness. The imagined social threat of the homosexual to the establishment causes it to define homosexuality as an evil in whatever semantics that society involves. In our times, science, rather than God, seems to be the last respected repository of ignorance, and illness is more generally feared than evil, more generally feared evil than either sin or crime. The recent revision of the APA position is very important.
Hello, Toby. This is Shirley Willer. I'd like to first make a request for Marion. She would prefer that you use the name Meredith Gray in your paper, as she does have a family who is unaware of her orientation. You ask for a short profile of us. Mine may not be so short, as I do not dislike talking about myself. I was born in 1922 in Chicago, Illinois, of what would now be called middle-class parentage. My ancestry was Austrian-German. My parents were somewhat, quote, advanced, end quote, for their age. You might say that I was always an upfront lesbian. That is, as soon as I recognized my sexual orientation for what it was. My first truly repressive experience was rather in the area of women's rights when in high school I discovered that there were separate lists of majors that students could select from when they were planning their careers, one for girls and one for boys. When I objected, they firmly insisted that I select one from the girls' list. It would be best for me. With much rebellion, I selected that which I thought would give me the most freedom and money-earning ability. My choice was not impossible, since as a registered nurse, I was able to move freely about the country, always assured of a rapid acceptance in the working world. I was always a sexual being, precocious, you might say. Having had sexual experiences with men, even before my 16th year, this, however, always lacked the element of importance to me. I truly felt that I had no capacity for love. Many years later, I discovered that my strong desire for the presence of and physical contact with women was not the usual, but the unusual. That, in fact, there were but comparatively few of us who had this gift, and that its name was homosexuality. Can you today envision a world in which, in a well-read family, there was no material which contained either the word homosexual or lesbian, much less any description or discussion of the phenomena? There was so little information available, even in later years, that I was suspended from one of the nursing schools I attended as a lesbian, even though at that time I was not aware of my own orientation. I just felt that the rest of the women in the school were being silly to waste so much of their time on men, when there were other things of more interest in the nurse's residence. It was still later that I encountered the information that revealed me to myself. With great excitement, I hurried home to my family and informed them proudly that I was gay. Although stunned, there was never any rejection of me by my family or friends. I gather this was a rare exception to the experience of both the gay men and women of my time. I went through the usual processes of trying to conform, mainly as a matter of practicality in the world of the 1940s. But when the mental health psychiatrist irritatedly said, "Tell her to let her hair grow, get out of that woman's dorm and find herself a man," I walked out with the resolution that she was an inflated bag of nonsense, and in living my life, I would do it my way. This has been my practice ever since, and I've never regretted it. I've never made my sexual orientation a secret, either in my profession or in my private life. If anyone could not accept me as friend or employee, as my total self, I did not need either their companionship or their job. I may mention that I've never lost a job, either for this or any other reason. Being without worry about financial security led me to move freely about the country, living and working for many years in most of the major cities across the United States. My life has been full of joyful experiences, which of recent years I've been more and more aware. Now to my entrance into the homophile revolution. You must be aware that prior to 1950, there were no organized groups of homosexuals anywhere in the country. I understand that the first organization was a secret society called first the Circle of Friends, which became the first Mattachine Society. They began around 1952 to print a magazine called One. My first encounter with the concept of organization was when one of my many male homosexual friends gave me some copies of that magazine. Enthusiastically, I both subscribed to the magazine and sought out all of their previously printed copies. This was about the time they were having their historic battle with the United States Post Office. There were, however, no activities or meetings of any kind that I could discover in the city of Chicago where I was at that time. Thus, my only participation in any active way remained in the future when I moved to New York City. As an aside, I would like to give you, if possible, a picture of the life of a lesbian during my youth. It was a time of role-playing. You were either a butch or a femme. The butch wore clothing as masculine as possible, if not men's clothing. The femme had to outdo the most feminine of women. My experience being limited in the social area of lesbian activity, I frequently encountered suspicion among lesbians, the people I most wished to associate with. I was even suspected of being a police spy. Thus I tended to assume the coloration of the time, becoming more and more masculine in my dress and actions for the purpose of achieving acceptance. Much of this veneer has been impossible to remove, even today, although I've never desired or approved of such role-playing. You will find this true among many of the women of my age, who may or may not like it. We had to live with it. The only organized activities that were available to us at that time were things such as softball teams, bowling teams, and the annual Halloween balls, which were the huge, grandiose event of the year, planned all year from year to year and held in the largest and swankiest ballrooms in the city. I had a large association among the gay men in the city, partially because of my acquaintance with many male nurses. One of the reasons I became militant in my desire for organized rebellion against society's attitudes concerns one of these male nurses. Barney was a charming young fab boy type who was working nights as a male nurse and going to school at the same time, hoping eventually to get his engineering degree. Our working hours at that time were usually 12-hour shifts. While waiting for a friend to pick him up one day, driving to school, Barney fell asleep on his couch with a cigarette in his hand. When the friend arrived, the couch and Barney were two-thirds burnt. He was taken to a neighboring hospital for treatment. The hospital was run by an order of Catholic brothers, would not allow any women as visitors, patients, or nurses. My male associates formed a volunteer group and specialed Barney throughout his stay there. Our fears and hostilities were aroused when we realized that Barney was receiving only minimal care, narcotics and little else. When our men objected, they were told, "Well, it doesn't really matter. You see, he's one of those." We immediately went to the Veterans Hospital and asked for a transfer for him. It took some discussion since we were the only family that Barney had, but they agreed to move him. They did, 3 days later. That night, Barney died, and so did a little of all the rest of us. I don't think that will ever quit hurting. Some months later, a year or so, word was passed that there was going to be a meeting of people discussing formation of an organization, presumably the Daughters of Bilitis. Although I had never heard of them, it sounded as though it might be what I was looking for. I attended the meeting, which was rather vague, chaired, as far as I could tell, by a man who was a stranger to me, and some of the various problems of homosexuals in general were discussed. I was disappointed in that it did not seem to lead to any activity, and to my knowledge, there was never another meeting called. I did, however, obtain a name and address in New York, which was supposed to be of an active and working chapter of the Daughters of Bilitis. I was not aware of the Mattachine Society and its work, or I might have had a completely different future ahead. My mother, who had worked for about 25 years at the State Mental Hospital in Chicago, had finally become too ill to continue in her job. I persuaded her to move to Florida, where her sisters and brother lived, bought her a home, and returned to Chicago long enough to liquidate our place there and prepared to move to New York. Among the first things I did upon my arrival in New York was to write to the Daughters of Bilitis. I received in return a most gracious letter inviting me to attend a meeting of the group the following month. I could hardly wait. When the appointed date arrived, I somewhat trepidatiously sought out the address. The meeting convened and discussion began about, of all things, the wording of a brochure for the Daughters and how they might phrase or rephrase the purpose of the Daughters of Bilitis. Somewhat disappointed in the work being done, I did not realize that in the near future I would experience the utmost in frustration because of the limitations imposed by that document and by the bylaws of the organization. I looked for a rebellion, a revolution, and I discovered a social club devoted to self-help, consultations with psychiatrists in the church, endless programs of self-analysis and reassurance to women who needed their hands held, and yet I was working.